ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hot Rod and Dragster Show. The Donker Dome.
Well, someone's had a little bit too much time on their hands this week.
Oh, Chris. Well played, Chris. If I'm not completely mistaken, I believe there was a lion attacking someone with a laser gun in somewhere in the middle of that.
That's the effect I was after, yeah.
That is a radio show that... well, it's not even that you have to listen to. No, you can't avoid it.
So this is the Hot Rod and Dragster Show, or as it was known, the Bugle. With me, the Dragster, Andy Zaltzman in London. And Hot Rod himself, John Oliver, yes, in New York City.
Pew, pew, pew! Hey, Dragster, Hot Rod here, rocking the mic. Weather on the ones. Andy, I was in New Hampshire on Monday. Hello, Buglers, by the way.
Oh, hello, yeah, we kind of missed that formality out. Hello, Buglers.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing how something that spectacular knocks you out of your rhythm, the sound of something being gored to death.
That's why the Spaniards never get anything done.
I was in New Hampshire, Andy, on Monday for the first Republican presidential debate, as I was lucky enough to not exactly be invited, but to not be turned away by security from it. And it was both a privilege and a contractual obligation to be there, to see a presidential campaign kick into life a full 17 months before the actual election. 17 months, Andy. That's nearly a year and a half. That is literally too f***ing early. Now, it was very nearly a completely pointless exercise, rendered even more meaningless by some of the questions asked of the candidates, such as, and I quote, Johnny Cash or Elvis? BlackBerry or iPhone? American Idol or Dancing with the Stars? Deep dish or thin crust pizza? Those, Andy, are not questions to ask someone running for president. Those are bad icebreakers on an awkward first date.
Isn't that what it basically is, though?
that is kind of true.
And when they say Johnny Cash or Elvis, do they mean whose music do you prefer, or who would you rather see brought back from the dead, or who would you like to see up in front of The Hague charged with war crimes?
That was never specified, Andy. There may have been more depth to the question than I'm giving it credit for.
There's a lot of subtext of these things, Johnny.
But I do think when I heard the deep dish or thin crust question, I distinctly heard the thudding sound of journalism hitting rock bottom. But the problem is, I think it hit the bottom so hard that I'm worried it's broken clean through the rock bottom to expose a hidden cave underneath to allow them to sink even lower. I wouldn't be remotely surprised if the final presidential debate next year features a question where they're both asked what their favourite donut flavours are. Now, we were shooting a piece up there, treating the whole thing like a horror film, hoping to basically make it a horror movie trailer for the upcoming campaign. So I'd taken in fake blood, two twin 8-year-old girls and a huge plastic axe with me.
Which, just like you want your old gigs back here, John.
Yeah, I guess it's a little surprising for security when most reporters are generally just bringing in a notepad.
How do the 8-year-old girls cope with it, John?
It's a little early for them to be, witnessing point blank that level of futility.
That's what happened to the Olsen sisters at the same age. So this is Bugle 158 for the week beginning Monday, the 20th of June, 2011. As always, the section of the Bugle is going straight in the bin this week. It's the Bugle Agony Aunt section. Including Dear Bugle Agony Aunts, I've just got my arm stuck in some industrial machinery. It's really, really painful. Agony, in fact. Any tips? And Dear Bugle Agony Aunt, I'm a hitman. I've been hired by a wealthy, jealous husband to bump off the man his wife is having an affair with. It's a really good deal financially and could set me up for life. Unfortunately, the man his wife is having the affair with is me. What should I do? And Dear Bugle Agony Aunt, I'm a 27-year-old woman. My eldest sister recently married the future King of the United Kingdom. Since then, I've had this strange, uneasy sensation of 7 billion people staring at my arse. Am I being paranoid? And we would be answering all of those if it hadn't gone straight in the bin.
Top story this week, Strike War! on Greece. Andy, or shall I say Dragster, with economies around Europe still reeling from the global economic luge run of a couple of years ago when the world's economy went downhill so fast the Swiss people were banging cowbells at it, a series of savage austerity measures have been put into place. And when it comes to savage austerity measures, Greece is still the gold standard, or what used to be the gold standard in Greece. Apparently they've now downgraded that term to the copper standard in a cost-cutting measure because they can't even afford the word gold anymore. Frankly, Greece currently leads the way in making your country a miserable place to live in. Where they lead, other struggling economies are likely to follow, dragging their feet and muttering about how this is complete bullshit.
Well, of course, things, I mean, we know things are tough in Greece. They still haven't put the roof on the Acropolis, so it's kind of understandable.
The Greek Prime Minister is being forced to form a unity government after widespread protests at the savage austerity measures that the IMF and the European Union are forcing Greeks to put into place. And put it this way, if you see people in Athens wearing togas a lot over the next few years, it may not be part of a tourist gimmick or an Animal House convention. It's probably just the only article of clothing they can afford anymore. Never mind the Mao suit in China, get ready for the Papandreou toga, which will be a white sheet with an elastic band for the belt. It's like the European Union have basically staged an intervention on Greece, saying, listen, you've developed a major problem with debt. It's not just hurting your economy. It's hurting everyone's economies around you. And we're just not going to let you continue this cycle of abuse that's proving so painful. Except, traditionally in an intervention, you then offer calm words of support and love. But in this case, all the countries are just starting to beat the shit out of Greece and then take everything from its house.
There's one report in the paper saying that the EU financial ministers are meeting at a summit next week and, quotes, if they don't come up with a workable solution, the bond and financial markets will be merciless. This is the problem, John. The markets basically behave like a cartoon baddie. They're sort of like a cross between a vampire and Kim Jong-il.
There have been massive strikes and public protests in the streets of Greece all week where people have been calling the measures a tragedy. And bear in mind that this is Greece. They pretty much invented the word tragedy. And yet they are, even they are pissed off at the proposed level of pain they're being asked to endure. And again, this is Greece, Andy, the country that invented a guy who blinded himself after banging his own mother. It's
well, maybe that's like, maybe that's what they mean by this is a tragedy. It means that well, my mum's looking quite hot today. She's put on a summer dress. You know?
It's like the Greek economy has been treated like a piece of disgusting meat, shoved onto a spike and mechanically rotated in a window so everyone can see it get cooked. Andy, I'm saying the Greek economy is like a kebab because they love kebabs there. It's like if the Greeks were Belgians and kebabs were waffles. Why? Because Belgians love waffles, Andy. They can't resist. If you put a waffle on the end of a fishing line and drove through Brussels, you'd have a 220-pound Belgian mounted you all by the end of the afternoon. The concern is that if Greece defaults on its debt, there could be widespread panic, so countries are taking measures to prevent that from happening. Germany wants bondholders to provide a further 30 billion euros of relief by getting Athens lenders to swap their bonds for new ones with extended 7-year maturities, and that would give Greece more time to reform its economy, although it wouldn't wipe any of the debt obligations away. Now, you might think that sounds a lot like defaulting on a debt, and most credit agencies would agree with you, but politicians in Brussels are calling it a reprofiling of loans. So that's the new plan to stop Greek defaulting, changing the word default altogether. That seems, at best, a short-term solution. Whatever happens, it is clear that Greek people are no longer in control of their own destiny because the IMF has got Greece by its falafels and is squeezing hard. Now, because they like falafels, Andy! commentators.
Do they?
Yeah.
The Greeks?
Yeah, they do. They do must they? Do. They
really?
Just must do.
Isn't that
yeah,
more of an Israeli thing, John?
Nah, the Greeks probably like it as well.
Well, anything that isn't f***ing cucumber and yoghurt for a change. I guess it's got to have a bit of an attraction.
Comments at the protests oscillated between rage and despair. One demonstrator spoke of a country being torn to pieces. People in the streets were carrying signs reading, no to the IMF, no more loans. Sorry for the unforgivable negativity of Greece in the European Championships of 2004. We go together like do what. We go together like do-wop-do-waddy-waddy shamalama-ding-dong. Another sign reading, no, actually, we're not that kind of Greece. The first one reading, my mistake, I confused us with the musical Greece. Another one reading, don't worry about it, we got much more important things to worry about than that minor slip-up. Though, to be honest, I find it hard to believe that that wasn't deliberate. The first one reading, are you calling me a liar? Go f*** yourself! So, you can see, there were chaotic scenes on the streets, Andy.
Well, I guess the most important thing for the Greek people is that they just stick to what they know best and continue eating cucumber, yogurt and garlic. I think that's the key to the situation.
Well, here's an interesting side note to that, Andy. Greek police were firing tear gas at protesters outside Parliament, and demonstrators apparently responded by throwing stones and yogurt at them. They threw yogurt, Andy, and presumably they might have thrown tzatziki sauce as well, just so they can completely conform to a national stereotype. Did they chuck some honey at the police after throwing the yoghurt as well? Quite a viscous yoghurt they must have thrown as well. That's, I guess, what makes it a signature riot chucker.
Well, because you've got a bit more... It's less likely to just dissipate mid-throw than a runnier kind of Western European yoghurt. So, I mean, it's got fantastic ballistic properties, but also still gives you an extremely effective splatter on landing.
Much better yoghurt for the disaffected youth, the Greek yoghurt. So, you know, you got to focus on the positives, Greece. You know, your yoghurt will get you through this.
Yep, and if not, then just strip off, oil up, and wrestle each other.
Basically go back to square one.
Yeah, just do a bit of philosophy, it'll be fine.
A lot of good things came from Greek people stripping naked and wrestling each other. Maybe that'll kickstart. That'll be the jump start to their economy.
They just need to start
naked wrestling again.
They need to start charging royalties every time anyone uses democracy or literature or sport. Yeah. They'll be fine.
Strike to Britain!
Yep. We're going on strike as well. That one's just drifting into the top of the strike zone there. And it's 0-2. Europe is 0-2 now in a bit of a hole.
And Terry Francona has seen enough.
There's a strike by a number of public service unions set for the 30th of June. And, John, the way I see it is if they wanted to watch the Wimbledon women's semi-finals that much, why couldn't they just book a date holiday like the rest of us? Or kidnap Yelena Yankovic's parents and pretend to be them. And hope that she has a better-than-usual Wimbledon. But is this set to be perhaps the biggest act of civil disobedience in Britain since we painted ourselves blue to make the invading Romans think it was even colder here than it actually was? And it's caused a lot of... obviously, the cuts programme is causing a lot of division, John. Bob Crowe, the head of the RMT union, suggested that benefit claimants and pensioners should sit across the carriageway of the M25.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I don't know if that's an interesting way of spending the day. Or the fact that we all love a game of Skittles and it's what God gave us front bumpers for. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's a way of solving the pension crisis, basically having people wiped out in the middle of the road.
But this is what it all comes down to, John. It is all about pensions. And the government is saying that people in public sector pensions are going to have to work longer, pay more into their pensions and get less out of it at the end due to the fact that we are living longer and longer and steadfastly refusing to die. And... this problem became inevitable, John, and I'll tell you who I blame. I blame all these do-gooding so-called medical scientists, and when they started working on medicines and stuff that have kept us alive longer and longer. These are just some of the people that I hold directly responsible for the fact that we are facing a national crisis and the public sector going on strike. One, Edward Jenner, invented vaccination in the early 19th century, hammered smallpox right in the nuts, at considerable expense to me, the taxpayer. William Morton, number two, pioneering anaesthetist. If it wasn't for
scumbag.
Him, not so many people would be quite so keen to have life-saving operations. Little Joey Lister, the Bernie Big Bollocks of 19th century antiseptics.
Louis Shame on you, Bernie.
Louis Pasteur, he's cost me a load of wedge when he started piddling around with milk. The list of these often literal bloodsuckers on public funds goes on and on. Alexander f***ing Fleming, the scourge
of the
scourge of the bacteria community, a scourge on my wallet more like. Watson and Crick, DNA. What does that stand for?
Tools!
Do not ask how much their discovery has put on the cost of the public pension pot. And I hate to say this, John, but also on the blame list, Florence Nightingale.
Oh,
nurse.
Oh, no.
Lean over me once more and I'll definitely stay alive for another 24. But it's not just medicine either, John. John Logie Shitting Bear is on this list as well. He invented telly, he gave old people an excuse to carry on living. In the old days, they'd have just sat around on a bench and died. And now it's, I think I'll cling on to the precipice of existence until another series of celebrity hitmen, or so you think you can puke in a bucket, or Messiah Idol. And Nikita bollocking Khrushchev, John. He should have obliterated the world in a nuclear war when he had the chance. I mean, because then at least we wouldn't be forking out for teachers, nurses and soldiers to have a partially dignified retirement. Now, I mean, I know this sounds extreme, and medicine is not all bad. I mean, without it, statistically, one or both of me and John would have died in infancy after grazing a knee, falling off a plague-ridden donkey or something. And, of course, about half of you buglers would be desperately trying to download this podcast despite having been dead. But there are hidden costs as well to this, John. Take the Iraq War. What's that cost? About $1 trillion, the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. Now, in the old days, before medical science was invented, so we would have invaded somewhere, taken along a cheesy dose of smallpox, bing, bang, bosh, and then a few years, you've wiped out 95% of the indigenous population. Problem solved. Thank you, science. So when my local primary school can't afford a full-scale replica trebuchet catapult to A, make ancient warfare accessible for young children, and B, give teachers a potential punishment that kids will actually be worried about, read your book, little Timmy, or do you want to go and play with Colonel Katwang? I know when they can't afford that, or pencils, or whatever they use these days, I'll know who to blame, John. Louis Pasteur and interfering busybodies like him. It's got to stop, John. It has to stop.
We're calling you out, Louis Pasteur!
There has been some criticism about the ballots for the strike action. It only had a 32% turnout. And government ministers have said this show there was extremely limited support for the strike, which is not the rhetoric politicians usually use when there's a low turnout at something. I don't recall Tony Blair standing on his special white horse outside Downing Street after the 2005 election, triumphantly proclaiming, "Winning 35% of a 60% turnout shows extremely limited support for me and my bunch of losers in the Labour Party. The people of Britain have therefore given us a mandate to continue disappointing as many of them as possible, and we will strive to do that with all our might. Giddy up, Maureen." That's right, Blair had a horse called Maureen. And in cabinet meetings, he used to sit on a 500cc Yamaha motorbike, revving it whenever he got cross. That's a fact, John. It's in his autobiography. Or was that Barry Sheen? Maybe that was Barry Sheen.
That's good leadership.
You should never read two autobiographies at the same time. Always gets confusion. I still don't understand why Miley Cyrus was Hitler's favourite architect. Or why Albert Speer was willing to let himself become a teenage sex object. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah, the cricket, what was it? 144/7. The solution to this, John, is that we should all get given a pension of £50,000 in cash at the age of 21. Now, you can either save it for your old age, or you can blow it on wine, women and song. Or specifically on 63,000 songs at 79p each on iTunes, if you're not into wine and women. I'd say the best balance is probably about 2,500 bottles of mid-range supermarket wine at £5.95 each, 19,000 songs on iTunes, leaving you enough to buy two women at the current sale price of £9,995. It's not illegal, they're ex-government workers being sold off. It's a decent price, decent price.
Strike three! Canadians hitting things! Andy, it basically turns out this week everyone has their breaking point. For Greece, it's complete national bankruptcy. For the UK, it's broken promises over pensions. But for the Canadians, Andy, it's losing ice hockey games. Because the normally famously polite and reserved Canadians went batshit crazy. Or, I guess in their case, beaver shit crazy. When they lost Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals on Wednesday night. There were over 100 arrests on the streets of Vancouver, and the chief constable there said people chanted obscenities, and witnesses said some people took their anger out on nearby cars. 15 vehicles were burned, including two police vehicles. Now, bear in mind that those are Canadian obscenities, Andy. Those are not obscenities that are going to get you fined in Australia. But it's all relative. You know, saying the word crap in Alberta can get you a 6-year jail term.
Can it?
No.
Well, it's good that people still care enough about sport to bother rioting, yeah. John. Because, you know, it's become awfully corporatised these days, so...
Yeah. You know, I think it gives you a belief in the human spirit, what yeah. Canada did, because, you know, they love hockey, Andy. They love hockey like... I don't know, like the Greeks love kebabs and like the Belgians love waffles, Andy! If the Belgians ever lost a waffle-eating contest to Boston, you better believe that Bruges will be in flames by the morning.
But we, our sports fans have been getting worked up here as well, particularly Aston Villa fans, John. They've been protesting about the appointments of the former manager of their local rivals, Birmingham City. Alex McLeish has been made Aston Villa manager. And there have been protests, hundreds of fans chanting anti-McLeish slogans, daubing anti-McLeish graffiti. They've basically been protesting as if their club had just announced that they had appointed as their new manager, not McLeish, but the new Al-Qaeda number one, Ayman al-Zawahiri. On which subject, to be honest, I'm not sure that Zawahiri is really the man, either for Aston Villa, or to detoxify the failing Al-Qaeda brand. I mean, I thought they might have gone for someone with a little more positive public profile, you know, maybe Bill Gates. I think it would be an interesting challenge for the former Maharaja of Microsoft. I mean, if anything can turn things around for an organisation like Al-Qaeda, it has to be Gates. And I think... well, what do you think, Buglers? Would you like to see Bill Gates as head of Al-Qaeda? We know he responds to the public. Let's put this to the vote. I have actually been told there were top-level talks, but the Al-Qaeda board felt that their supporters weren't quite ready to embrace Bill Gates' more philanthropic, less anti-Western approach to resolving the world's problems. But... that's bowing to fan power, if you ask me. It's no wonder they haven't won a major trophy for years.
Hacking news now! And the increasingly infamous computer hackers Lulz Security have struck again. They became notorious after repeatedly attacking the Sony PlayStation network, compromising the information of its 77 million members worldwide and infuriating 13-year-old boys who wanted to shoot each other with blast guns all over the world. But
they it's really nothing sacred, John.
I know. You know, everyone has their limit, Andy. And that's the kind of thing that can get 13-year-olds to try and lift cars and turn them over in the street. But Lulz Security really stepped it up a notch this week when they took down the CIA's website. And the best part of this is that it was all apparently done to impress a stranger who'd been goading them on Twitter. Basically, a user named Quadropocticoni and Lulzek, which is their Twitter name, got into an argument after Quadropocticoni, I refuse to keep pronouncing that accurately, complained that they were only attacking soft targets, like video game companies. He said, "Stop calling yourselves hackers. You're giving real hackers a bad name. Here's a real challenge. FBI.gov or CIA.gov. Try changing text or something." Wow. That's quite a way to settle a score, Andy. If you really want to impress me, take down the website of one of the most powerful forces on Earth. And yet, the goading clearly worked, because Lowell's then replied, "Hey, Jackhammer." Which is a great thing to call someone. "Hey, Jackhammer." He said, "Hey, Jackhammer, get some attention span. We've hit two agency websites already." And then, less than an hour later, CIA.gov went down. And you might think that would have settled the argument, but Quadropocticoni, or whatever they're called, was still not impressed, writing, "Site up, nothing's changed, lulz." Well, f*** you. There is no impressing that ridiculously titled Twitter user.
Of course, the CIA site is mostly just message boards giggling about how they still haven't been officially nailed for the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, the Queen Mother, or Jesus. So, you know, was it worth the hack, I ask you? They also hacked into a database of X Factor contestants containing the contact information of 73,000 contestants. Well done, Lulz! You stick it to the man! That was one of the most pointless acts of civil disobedience in history.
You don't know that, Andy. You don't know.
I mean, I'm not.
You don't know what information is down there.
I'm not one to criticise people for not applying their intellectual gifts to the most useful possible outlet. You know, I wouldn't have a leg to stand on. In fact, I'd barely even have two bleeding stumps to wriggle around on. But come on. I mean, you could take down Al-Qaeda. You could turn Mahmoud Ahmadinejad into an online recipe. Come on, do something useful. I don't know if it was Lulz, but apparently the IMF servers have also been hacked into. So presumably there was the opportunity at that point to transfer loads of money from Switzerland to Burundi, just to see what would happen to the global economy. And now, buglers, as demanded by you, the 7 billion people of the world, and as politely cautioned against by the lawyers of novelist John Grisham, it's part two of John Grisham's The Congressman's Penis. Discovered in the Bugle vaults last week. Now, I did put it to the public vote whether or not you wanted part two of The Congressman's Penis. And overwhelmingly, you do.
That's and, democracy.
I mean, some people did say, please, please, no part two. For the love of God, no. Well, but yeah, you cannot go against the will of the people. Now, to take you back, last time, Mickey Stantonio, washing up detective. Sorry, washed up detective. So important to get the tenses right. Woke one morning in his Philadelphia motel to find a congressman's penis in a box. Just as that penis was about to reveal which congressman it belonged to, it was wangnapped by an as yet unknown assailant. Leaving Mickey Stantonio PI to investigate. The Congressman's Penis. Chapter 2. The Crotch of Despair. Mickey Stantonio ran out of menopausal Brenda's onto the intersection at 13th and Gooch. There was no sign of that Congressman's penis. Not so much as a single stray foreskin. Hey, lady, he shouted at a passing man. You schmuck, replied the man. I'm sorry, apologized Stantonio. I just had breakfast. That's no excuse, you mongrel screwing ball strain, said the man. Fair point, said Stantonio, but you are wearing a dress, and you got a cracking set of... Hey, have some respect for a dame, said the man. Sorry, sir. I'm Mickey Stantonio, private investigator. What's your name? Bridget Paranovskaya. That's a funny name for a guy around these parts. Who says I'm a guy? You did. Oh, yeah, I'm always getting them mixed up. No, I'm a gal. That's the one. Gal, you were right first time. Man, has that little confusion got me into some scrapes. Mickey Stantonio, PI, felt a surge of confidence coursing through his detective's veins. He still had it. It might only have been a small thing like telling a guy from a girl, but he still had it. That's the old Mickey, he cuddled himself. I'm going to find that penis and reattach it to the right congressman. What did you say, asked Bridget? Sultrily sucking on a pickled herring. Did I say that out loud? Asked Mickey. You did. Loud as a fluorescent chicken in a farmyard full of grey ducks. Care to explain? Maybe you'd like to care to explain, lady, exploded Stantonio. His old confidence had not just come back. It had put its slippers on, helped itself to a beer from the refrigerator, and resoundingly broken wind on the sofa. It had come home to stay. Lady, tell me straight. Have you seen a congressman's penis? Why, sure I have. Where was it? Who was it with? Where did it go? I'll answer those questions in turn, she said. One, it was on a congressman. Two, it was with the congressman. And three, do you want me to draw you a diagram? No need, lady. I think we might be talking about different congressmen's penises here. I need to find that penis. I'm going to split, Miss Paranovskaya. Paranovskaya, what is that? Venezuelan? Russian. Okay. Sure, Miss Paranovskaya. What is that, Venezuelan? There was an awkward pause in that Philadelphian air. Sorry, said Mickey Stantonio. So, the penis. Long story, you got a smoke? Yeah, I got smoke, said Bridget. I got this canister of the stuff from a fire at a rubber factory. I was taking it over to my mother's hospice. She loves the smell of burning tire. Who doesn't, said Mickey, breathing in the fumes. Apart from old Joey Struber, of course. The late old Joey Struber. Joey Struber's dead, asked Bridget. Yeah, did you know him? No. Why did you ask if he was dead? In case I ever meet him. How did he die? Well, he was working undercover as the wheel on an illegal dump truck. Driver tried to speed away from the cops at a junction. Wheel spin, left Joey marks all over the road. Still, it's the way he would have wanted to go. Really? Yep, piece of crap out of being eaten by a communist in a crocodile outfit. And Joey saw it as an either-or. So he died with a smile on his face. Well, sounds like he died with a dump truck on his face. That too, sweet cakes. That too. So, the penis. I found it this morning, said Mickey. It's a congressman's penis, no doubt about it. How do you know? Asked the lady, kicking her Wellington boots against a nearby tramp to wear them in for a hard winter's booting. When you've been in this game as long as I have, said Mickey, you just know. You just know. So, lady, where do you think we might find a congressman's penis around here? I got a suggestion for you, grunted the lady, extricating her leg from the mouth of an irate tramp. You ain't gonna find a penis that small in the city this big. You need to do this by a process of elimination. To work out who is and who isn't missing a penis, You need to see as many congressmen in as trouserless state as possible. What, you mean go to Idaho and hang around at bus stops? No, I mean go to Congress. And like you're thinking, sizzly lips, he guzzled, arrogantly flicking the ash from her cigarette before her face caught fire again. But a congressman with no penis? Isn't that just a congresswoman? Not necessarily, Mickey Stantanio, she said. Not necessarily. Anyway, 3 days and one very long donkey ride later, Mickey Stantanio and Bridget rode into Washington, hotly pursued by an angry donkey rental salesman shouting, "You only booked it for a f***ing hour, you pair of thieving shitbags!" "You know more than you're letting on, don't you, lady?" said Mickey, realizing he was conversationally remortgaging himself, but unsure about the interest rate. "Sure I do, Mickey. I got a degree in 17th century French literature. I could tell you all about Molière, but I didn't think you'd be interested, so I didn't let on. Anyway, this can wait. We gotta break into Congress and start looking at some penises. Well, that congressman's penis is gonna be little more than an on-pastried sausage roll for the rest of its life. To be continued."
Well, and I mean, it doesn't obey the conventional laws of literature.
Right.
In that, you know, you meet characters, suddenly get introduced and then disappear.
Yeah.
There's, you know, it's hard to follow. I don't want to say impossible, but right. It feels impossible.
Well, right.
But, I mean, it moves along at a cracking pace.
Yep. Now, it might be something to do with the fact that that I wrote it at about 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hooked.
Yeah. You know, this is kind of how Dickens wrote, Andy. I mean, yeah. He serialised his novels chapter by chapter. Yeah. Whilst writing them at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Fast, you know, without rereading them once the words were on the page. It's the same. So, yeah. You know, who knows? One day, maybe, you know, you'll be seen as, you know, a classic writer and all your works will become period dramas that the BBC will excel in selling worldwide.
Didn't you appear in a period drama, Dickens?
I did, Andy. It's the first thing... First thing I ever did. Yeah. I was 6 years old. I was in Bleak House.
Right.
The baby. I was Felix Partigal, an orphan.
Right.
Yeah.
Bleak House.
Incredible performance.
Bleak House was pretty much a two-word description of my first Edinburgh run. Your emails now, and the unquestioned email of the week came from Asaf Bittner, writing from Ra'anana. Is that right? Ra'anana in Israel. That sounds like a made-up place. But anyway, it's some fantastic philosophy-based puns. But I've been told by my Bugle colleagues, yeah. We've had too many puns recently, so I'm going to have to save it.
Chris and I have stepped in kind of like the way that the Red Cross steps in during potential humanitarian crises. We just can't, in good conscience, let it happen.
So, we've got a week off the Bugle next week, so we'll have a fill-in Bugle with spare stuff. But the week after that, Asaf Bittner's puns will see the light of day. we've had some excellent other emails as well. This one on the subject of Elk River Invasion. Let's strike a deal from Christopher, who writes, "Dear John, Andy and Chris... and to any of those involved in the upcoming Elk River invasion. I know what you're planning to do, and I want in. I've lived in Elk River for my entire life, and my boundless hate for this town and its residents has become more powerful than the clenching power of Pippa Middleton's buttocks."
Oh, Pippa.
"The Elk Riverians are simple and modest folk, but I have my suspicions, unproven as they may be, that behind their calm, bearded faces, there is a maniacal passion to end the world. I do not know when they plan to execute this destruction, but I urge you to strike quickly and preemptively. Over the years, I've assimilated myself into their society with relative ease, although I've yet to be invited to their secret meeting headquarters. Regardless, these scum need to be wiped off the face of the earth."
Wow.
"Now, I was hoping that I might be of service to you. I think it's safe to say that we share an equal passion for eradicating Elk River, so I'd like to strike a deal. I will continue living my life normally until your invasion, gathering intel on my town and lulling these people into a false sense of security. Come time for the attack, you should know the following. 1, the town's weakest area of security is at the South Gate entrance next to Dylan's vacuum repair store. I strongly recommend that you breach the town here. 2, our water comes from a communal well 600 yards north of the town hall."
Oh, that's... That's good to know.
I've taken the measurements, and you would only need about 85 pounds of C4 or 130 pounds of TNT, whichever is more readily available.
Oh, this is getting specific. Uh-oh.
To be placed and detonated 27.5 feet from the water level.
Oh, I'm feeling out of my depth, Andy.
This will take out the townspeople's water supply, as well as the teenager's prime hookup spot.
Oh, my God. Oh, no. This has a momentum. It's like running downhill. I think a momentum's moving that we can't stop here, Andy.
Lastly, the town has a strict curfew of 6:30 p.m. Anyone seen outside will be shot on sight. Cannot be true. This can be used to your advantage. So in return, all I ask is that you take me back to London after the deed has been done. Actually, anywhere will suffice, as long as I get to escape from Elk River. Please hasten the preparations for your invasion. I can only survive here for so long. My sincerest regards, Christopher.
He's not coming with me.
Wow. That's great, Chris. After he's paid the ultimate sacrifice, you'll not offer him safe harbour.
You know, next it'll be Bethnal Green. It's
Well, that is outstanding. Yep. I mean, look, it's hard to... I guess it's a classic case of the kind of the inevitable slide towards war, where, you know, perhaps it's not really required. It's just, you know, we've invested in a badonkadonk, so, you know, financially you kind of want to use that. Now we have people on the ground calling for an intervention, so I guess we're at war with Elk River, Andy. I guess this is how it happens.
Yeah. I guess it gets into legal territory of whether a podcast can declare a war or not, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it's worth mentioning that we actually had a counter email from Jason Parton in Rupert, Idaho, who said, "Greetings, lords of the podcast Cyberwaves. I'm a citizen of the state of Idaho and humbly request that you do not invade Elk Creek."
Oh, right.
So what's this little pinko anti-war protester got to whine about, Andy? He said, "Having visited the hamlet a few times in my life, I can assure you that other than a ranch, there's not much there to offer the Bugle." We'll see about that. Now, while it's a very scenic area, it's in no way a strategic location for any type of further action. While we, the citizens of Idaho, would most graciously welcome our new overlords, I feel it my duty to inform you that this is a much ill-advised action. Although it would be an ideal testing ground for the Badonkadonk when it's been acquired. Wishing you all the best, Jason Parton." Well, I don't know, Jason, that seems like you've got something to hide.
Yes.
That's the kind of email written by someone who is hiding a nuclear weapons facility that needs to be taken out by a huge badonkadonk.
And this email comes in on the subject, "Osama bin Laden, where were you when?" And so I'm going to keep the name of the correspondent secret.
Yes, I think that's wise, and it'll become clear why.
"Dear John and Andy, I felt the need to contribute my where were you when story for when I found out Osama bin Laden had been killed. You see, I heard the news as I was inserting my finger into a 76-year-old man's rectum. Please allow me to elaborate. I'm a doctor."
No, okay. I was going to suggest just leaving it there, Andy. You'd already given him anonymity.
"I'm a doctor, currently finishing up my internship in internal medicine, and I was on call the night bin Laden was killed. I was paged by the nursing staff to perform a digital rectal exam. I was in the middle of said exam when the news broke on the television in my patient's room. I hadn't heard the news yet, and based on the puckering I felt around my finger, neither had he. I'm not sure who has the weirder where were you when story, me or my patient. Either way, I'm willing to bet I'm the only person in the world who found out the news while knuckle-deep in an old man's fudge tunnel, to use the medical term."
Well, that is... Thank you, Bugler, who will not be named. Thank you very, very much for that email. That is a... I mean, that's a high watermark, Andy. It's hard to see. And that is my favourite use of the word puckering that I've heard for some time.
Sport now, and tennis. Wimbledon begins on Monday. Honestly, it does. I wouldn't lie to you about that. Come on, I know not everything I say on this newscast is 100% true, but that, yep, that is a fact. You can check with your local MP or senator or despot. It's starting on Monday. First year, in fact, that it's being played without rackets. One kitchen utensil per player. You get more skill and touch back in the game. Should probably favour Federer with his aluminium-based frying pan. But you never know with Nadal. He's such an athlete, such a competitor, even if his chances of victory are definitely diminished by his insistence on playing with an ice cream maker. Industrial one too, a bit heavy for the grass, you'd think, but he's a strong boy, and if anyone can win Wimbledon with an industrial ice cream machine, it's Rafael Nadal. Could also distract his opponents by offering him a nice tasty ice cream at the changeover as well. Okay, fair call, I admit I slid off the wagon there, but so the Bugle forecast, John, who is going to win Wimbledon this year?
Tim Henman, Andy. Come on, Tim.
Well, it's
come on, Tim.
I mean, it's got to be his year, really.
Could be his year. Should be his year.
I mean, sooner or later, statistically, he's got to come good. The last 8 years have been won by either Federer or Nadal, but for the previous 124 Wimbledons, neither Federer nor Nadal won it. Now, as any half-decent statistician will tell you, you cannot be swayed by recent trends. So, statistically, there's only a 6.4% chance that Federer or Nadal is going to win this year. But the bookies haven't gotten onto this. They've still got those two as hot favourites, so this is your chance to win big. So go all in on everyone else with the official Bugle blessing. That's all from the Bugle this week. I'm going to go away and work a little bit harder on Chapter 3.
Now, well, hold on, Andy. Hold on. Hold on. I feel it might have been a two-chapter masterpiece.
We can't leave it. Can't leave it unsolved. You know, it's got to be at least a Chapter 3.
I sense romance.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Might get a bit saucy.
God, Chris, you really are hooked.
Definitely.
So, I've got 2 weeks. All right, we're off next week. Any buglers who are at Glastonbury, I'm doing the left field tent on the Friday. Do come along. I've never been to Glastonbury before, so I don't know. I'm hoping to do a duet with Bob Dylan if he's there. Is he there?
Yeah.
No, he's not there. Balls. So, anyway, but we'll be back again with a real Bugle in 2 weeks. Next week, we'll have some offcuts, some premium grade stuff that wasn't good enough the first time. Until then, goodbye.
Cheerio!